My name is Michael Jacobson. I'm a physician and a minister. I live in Cincinnati, Ohio, with my wife and two sons that are here in the audience. And I'm on staff at our church as a minister of medicine. And I direct a relatively new ministry called Provident Medical Institute. And our purpose is to really bring medicine back as a ministry of the church, while at the same time not bringing in heresy, false doctrine, and imbalance along with it, and idolatry. And today's presentation is entitled Three Spiritual Traps to Healthcare. However, we're probably only going to get past the first trap. And that's going to focus principally on the historical roots of both Orthodox and alternative medical practices. I want you to have some basic principles so that you understand how to discern whether or not a practice is from God or whether it's from the enemy. And it's from one or the other. There's no middle ground. And there are more and more philosophies which are coming upon the stage of medical care every day, it seems. And I cannot even present a fraction of them today. I'm going to go over the big ones, the ones that have already infiltrated the church all across the country. And pastors are practicing them, and yet they have very questionable roots. I want you to understand something. I'm an osteopathic physician. I chose that route because I felt the Lord directing me there. They have a very biblically based philosophy. It was founded by a preacher physician. If we have time, I'll share a little bit about him with you. I am very interested in nutrition, in prevention, and in healing, and I do not have a strong allegiance to the Orthodox medical profession. It has its place, and it is certainly excellent in its scope when it's properly applied. But I also believe that nutrition is as well, and that is God's medicine for us many times, and that if we follow His ways, we wouldn't get these diseases that the Egyptians had, which are cancer and arthritis and cardiovascular disease like we have today. But you're going to hear a lot of negative things from me about certain practices, and I just want you to understand that I am not a conventional Orthodox physician that says everything other than what we do as allopaths is quackery. I don't agree with that. But there are going to be some things that you're going to see maybe for the first time today that is a result of me being asked a lot of questions and me pursuing alternative medicine to learn what is more effective at dealing with some of these things like cancer and heart disease and arthritis and diabetes and so on than what I see myself being able to provide as an Orthodox practitioner. And so I came in running into, in fact, I took my wife to one of these practitioners and it seemed kind of funny, but I didn't know what to think. It just didn't seem quite right, and I didn't understand necessarily why until after I began to look back into the historical roots and so on. So I spent several months studying the history of medicine, and I am still just a learner. I have a little fraction of information. I wish I would have had this 15 years ago. I wish it was a major curriculum of our medical schools, because what is that statement? He who does not remember the past is condemned to repeat it. And we're repeating it. You're going to see that. All right? Let's start out with a case presentation. All right? I want to show you something here. This is a case of a 69-year-old white female who had been very health conscious for the last 25 or 30 years of her life. She's a very vibrant, solid Christian who had raised up four boys who all walked with God, more or less. They loved the Lord. And is married to a minister, retired minister. And they both got very interested in health and prevention and were on virtually no medications, either one of them, despite the fact they were both 69 years of age. They were doing great. They went and attended a seminar which proposed that God's diet for prevention of disease was vegetarianism, and that was based upon Genesis 1:29, and that anything other than that really destroys your body, animal products and so on. And she was on this diet, which is very rich in fruits and vegetables, especially, and especially raw food, for quite some time. I would say close to 2 years, if not more so, from what I recall, before she was diagnosed with severe uncontrolled hypertension. And she could not get her blood pressure down. And she did have some stress in her life where she would be worried about her son or her boys if there was something that was going on in their marriage relationships and not really walking with God as close as she would like them to see. So there was some stress there and so on. But she really struggled with this, and she tried even more, taking more and more supplements and trying herbal remedies and going to different practitioners and so on. And this started in November, and in February she had a massive stroke. She laid back in the back of her beautician's chair, and who leaned her head back, and all of a sudden she couldn't see, she couldn't speak, she couldn't swallow, she couldn't communicate. That was my mother. And it was a devastating thing, and it was a test of her faith. But she thought, and she wrote this in a note to our church, that as long as she followed this dietary program, and as long as she took this particular supplement and so on, she wouldn't get sick. She got devastatingly sick. In fact, she's coming home from the hospital today after her third or fourth stroke. We struggle with this. And this is a case that is typical. Hear it all the time. Things like this. Well, she asked me, and my mom and dad asked me, would you come with us to this practitioner as a chiropractor who is supposedly very experienced in nutrition? And evaluate what he's doing, because he's came very highly recommended to us by Christian friends, and they said that he's been very helpful to them, and we're looking for some help. Would you come along and see what he's doing? I took this photograph in the office there, and that's the practitioner's hands on the left and the patient's on the right. And what you see in the background is a computer. There's a metal tray on the shelf there. And then an electrode, a positive electrode, coming out the right side of the tray, which she is holding in her right hand, and a negative electrode, which the practitioner is holding in his hand. And he's testing various meridian points on her hand and wrist. And then the computer graphs the energy onto the screen, and if there's too much, and checks out all these different bodily functions and systems. And if there's too much energy or too little energy flow, then you'll see an imbalance on one side or the other. And you can look up and see the blue lines there. Some of them are kind of dead in the middle, and others are to the left, and some are to the right. And this is an imbalance of this energy flow, and when there's an imbalance, there's a problem in that system. So then he takes remedies, many of them were homeopathic remedies, and he sets them on that tray. And this current runs through that tray, and then he retests all these organ functions and systems and plots them out on the computer, and they see if the things improve with that remedy there. And he goes through several different remedies and finds the ones that seem to map out that properly on the computer so that energies get balanced. And once they're balanced, then he knows he's got the right energy treatments selected. And then he takes all of the remedies, all these bottles, and puts them on the tray together and runs the same test through. Then he takes her arm and has her hold it out to the side and strength tests it while she holds each remedy in her hand close to her chest. We've seen it done different ways. When my wife had it done, they put a magnet on her belly and the remedy on top of that, and then strength tested her. And if she was stronger with the remedy than without, that was confirmation that she needed it. If she was weaker than she did, then she was allergic to it, and if there was no change, it was of no benefit to her. And that's referred to as applied kinesiology. And then he would have her take the remedy one at a time and hold it, and then he quietly asked her, how many pills do you need? And if she was stronger with two, then that was all she needed. If she was still weak, then he would go to four, and he would go up to six. And then if she felt stronger with six, then that was the dosage that he prescribed to her, and then she left. Now, is there anything wrong with this picture? All right? We're going to talk about that, and hopefully by the time you get done here, you'll understand what's appropriate here, what's not, and how you can help others. The first trap that we're going to talk about here, if we get through all three, we'll see, is when pagan medical philosophies are employed which are not based in God's law. Now, God's law can be either written or it can be natural. All right? There is the written word of God, and that's called the law of nature's God. And then there's natural law, and that's the laws of nature. You ever heard that term, the laws of nature and of nature's God? That is what Clarence Thomas was arguing before the Senate confirmation panel, that there is a law higher than man's law, and that's the law of nature and laws of nature's God. If man's laws violate the laws of nature, then it's our job to make them in compliance with the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. So those are terms that were very common 200 years ago. We don't use them very much today. Let me give you an example of the law of nature, gravity. Now, does everybody in here believe in the doctrine of gravity? Is there anybody that does not believe in it? If you don't believe in it, you know, you don't have to believe in it. But it's just like anything else. You don't break God's law, it breaks you. And if you go out and step out of the three-story window, it doesn't matter if you believe in the law of gravity or not. It's going to rule over you. And I can tell you, based upon that law, which direction you're going to go. It is possible for a pagan practitioner to discover something in nature, and that's what we call scientific inquiry. It's the study of creation. And he can discover something that God has written into the law of nature and have no concept of the Creator whatsoever, or deny the Creator. And that's not necessarily bad or evil. You're not exposing yourself to evil if someone who is not even a believer teaches you something that is true. Okay? But if what he is proposing to you is not rooted in the laws of nature or in the laws of nature's God, then you're exposing yourself and you're going to make yourself vulnerable. Now, the question when it comes to health, without going into much detail, remember what we had in the Garden of Eden? We had man created male and female. Walk with God. God would come in the cool of the evening and fellowship with them. And there was a perfect harmony there between the man and the woman, complete transparency and openness with God. And one thing that really is substantial for health, they were immortal. God created these bodies to never die. He said that the day you sin, you will die. There was no death in the world prior to sin. Death entered in the world as a result of Adam's sin. There is something within every human being that longs for immortality and the health and so on that was with them in the garden, but they lost it. The question is, are we going to get it back? God's way or man's way? God's way is that you will enjoy long life and health if you keep God's commandments, keep God's wisdom, fear God, keep humble, keep your tongue from evil, be honest in transactions, abstain from immorality, keep a clear conscience, including not taking of communion unworthily, remaining free from jealousy and envy, and keeping a merry heart. Those are just some things that we've found in Scripture that are requirements for health and a long life. And I can't leave that up there long. I can give it to you later. But this is, by the way, is a condensation of a 14-hour weekend seminar in a church into two. That's the way they like to do things around here. All right? Now, there are three basic religious divisions then. The first one is somebody who looks at the world through the way God looks at it, through truth. And that is a biblical worldview, we call it. It's like taking a pair of glasses and saying, I am fallen man, and I will put these glasses on, and I look through those glasses, and now I can see truth clearly. If those glasses are the Word of God, which I say is the final authority for all of my thinking, and if I feel differently, or if a teacher teaches me differently, if it's contrary to the Word of God, then I'm going to believe this. That's a biblical worldview. All right? It teaches that man is made in the image of God, but that he's fallen, and that he is inferior to God and separate from his Creator. Now, there are other belief systems, like monism, which is a belief that there is no God. There's just energy. This energy permeates throughout the whole universe, and there's no distinction between a creator and creation. Or pantheism is essentially the same thing, where everything's God. It's in everything. Okay, it's really the same thing. All right? And then we have polytheism, which gets more clearly into divination and astrology and magic and so on, although it is prevalent in monistic cultures as well, or pantheistic cultures, because when you reject God, you just accept everything else. And this believes that there are many gods, and that we contact spirit beings through these means. Both of these other two, monistic or pantheistic cultures and polytheistic cultures, tend to place the control in man's hands. He tries to manipulate the spirit world and so on for his own gain, for his own health. And he says things, you have to say things in just a certain way. And Dan Rumberger did a great job in Indianapolis last year. I encourage you to get his tapes on biblical worldview. And he shows about how animistic cultures put man at the center. He's in control. Whereas in a biblical worldview, God is sovereign. And I appeal to him regarding issues of health and everything for that matter. So we have these three basic religious divisions. And I find it interesting that they tend to culturally come from certain areas of the globe. You have your monistic or pantheistic views coming mostly out of China and India, the Orient. Okay? And then you have your polytheistic worldviews and religious persuasions coming out of ancient Persia, which is now Iran, ancient Babylon, which is Iraq, Egypt, which is where Greece took much of its influence from, Rome also, very polytheistic culture. So we have these two roots. Now let's look at these and see what medical philosophies that they have spawned, because this is something that you will learn if you look into medical history. A nation's religious philosophy dictates its medical theory. A nation's religious belief system will dictate its medical theory. And we will interpret our data as we look at nature based upon our religious worldview. And in every ancient civilization, like Babylon and Egypt and so on, those empires, when they fell internally from corruption, moral decay, when they rejected their religious basis, even though it was essentially pagan, they lost their stability. And if you look in their medical writings, the closer they got to their downfall, in other words, the older the civilization, the more mature they were as a civilization, as an empire, the more decadent the culture became, the more superstitious their medicine became. It went from modestly scientific to just getting involved in magic and superstition and all that. Now, this is what's happening in America right now. We have rejected our religious faith, even though Christianity and the church did not bring to medicine very clearly an articulated worldview for how to interpret medical theory. It still had a tremendous influence, but now that our culture has wholesale rejected Christianity as its religious basis, in medicine you find them opening themselves up to anything. And you would think brilliant scientists, top physicians who have studied the body and studied science for years, would be more discriminating when it comes to what they would adopt as a philosophy of life. But it's incredible. They just open themselves up to anything and even bring it into their practices. And there was a seminar being held earlier this week at Harvard on alternative medicine, which had their homeopathy, chiropractic, shamanism, just obviously things that were linked with the occult. All right? It's coming in like a flood. And it's because there is nothing to stop it. There is no biblical worldview in medicine that says, hey, we need to stop here. And so they don't know what to do with it. So what happens in China? China's ancient medicine is really a result of the work of an ancient emperor. Some people think he's legendary. Supposedly lived 5,000 years ago and took dictation from the gods and recorded it in what's called the Yellow Emperor's Classic of Medicine. And this then has been handed down through thousands of years and has really been the basis upon which ancient Chinese medicine is practiced. One of the teachings is that man is integrated with the universe. And you've got to watch this because you're going to see it several times. And that man is a microcosm of the universe. And that if you want to affect the universe, you can affect man. If you want to affect man, you can affect the universe because they're related. And also that there are human organs which are microcosm of the macrocosm, the human body. So you can look at a person's ear and see the entire body mapped out in the ear, or their foot, or their eye, and so on. Microcosm and macrocosm is basically a doctrine that comes out of ancient China. There are five basic elements in ancient Chinese medicine: wood, fire, earth, water, and metal. We know this is not true, but this has been believed for centuries, thousands of years. And they also believe that there were five hollow organs and five solid. And then they would draw correlations between them and between seasons and so on. Their first doctors were shamans because they were practicing their religion in terms of healing. Okay? Now, the religion that is really behind all this in ancient China is Taoism. It's called the Way of the Universe. There are several things about it. First of all, they believe that it's the first cause, cosmic energy behind everything. There's a creator, he's still not primary. This is an impersonal energy. There's no personality to it, like we are made in God's image. Well, that wouldn't fit here because this is an energy, an impersonal material force, not a person. There are two faces of Tao which oppose each other and yet are one, and you all know what they are, yin and yang, and the symbol represents yin and yang, and you'll see it on various places. We saw one in Colorado Springs when we were there a few days ago above a Taekwondo facility. And the key here is that everything must be balanced, and there's no absolute good or evil. It's just imbalance. There's no moral nature to this. Ki energy is what permeates the universe and flows through all living beings through meridians or channels. And that the goal of life is harmony between man and the universe, and you can attain that in a number of different ways, including meditation techniques or breathing control or diet, exercise, and so on. So we have a pagan worldview, and we're going to develop this chart where we see these things traced. You have energy and balance theories that tend to come out of monistic or pantheistic cultures, and Taoism is the religion upon which those are largely based. Do you follow me so far? Now here's the first medical practice that is an outworking of that Taoist belief, and that's acupuncture. Now acupuncture comes from two Latin words meaning needle, to prick with a needle. And as I mentioned, ki energy goes through meridians. There are supposedly 12 meridians in human beings that this energy flows through. And health will be the result of having harmony between man and the universe, and when there's no blockage of this energy, when it's able to just flow through us and we're in sync with our cosmos, okay? Illness results when there's blockage of ki energy. Now, most of these things are in your notes there, in the section of the blue papers now. Some of the early slides with the case presentation was not. The treatment, then, is to remove the blockage, restore proper energy flow, and then you're going to have health as a result. Well, acupuncture is also then used to treat internal organs, and it's also been used very similarly as voodoo to expel evil spirits. It makes sense. It's very similar in terms of its connotation. Now, an acupuncturist will approach a patient in this way. He'll do an examination, spends a lot of time focusing on the tongue, the eyes, and pulses. There is supposed to be a pulse that correlates with each one of these meridians. There are six that flow through the wrists on each side. And so he will examine the wrists for a pulse, and Dr. Bonneville or Dr. Gardner can tell us maybe it's our Western mindset, and you know, we have a hard time feeling a radial pulse, but these guys are able to detect six pulses there. Physiologically impossible as far as the number of arteries that would produce that. But they're checking for energy pulses, all right? And they'll assess the health based upon that. Now, it's important to notice this. The Chinese had what is not even a contention, faulty anatomy and physiology for thousands of years, because they didn't allow any human dissection. They thought the spleen was the center of intelligence. It was the most vascular organ. And there are things that are really inaccurate in their anatomy and physiology that persist in ancient Oriental medicine. And if you were to go over to Peking and have surgery, you're not going to get acupuncture for your anesthesia. You're going to get Halothane or some other general anesthetic here. Western medicine has highly influenced China just as much as we find ancient Chinese medicine now influencing us. Everybody's looking for answers, and so but there are conventional medical schools in China, and there are the ancient Oriental schools, and practitioners, people can choose either one. And some Chinese doctors that I've talked to say we would prefer to use the Western medicine unless it's a chronic problem. Then we look at the herbs and things like that. And ancient Chinese medicine has a lot of information regarding herbal treatments for things. They use a tea, for example, for congestion that has ephedrine in it, Ma Wang. It's used as a dietary stimulant. And there's a physiologic basis for it. And it would make sense that people who have been using herbs for hundreds and thousands of years might know something about them. All right? But the question is what else are they associated with? All right? And are you just taking an herb like you would take a vitamin? Or are you taking an herb with the whole association that comes along with it? Now, there has been some research to try to explain acupuncture, because there seems to be some validity to it in the sense that it seems to work on some people. Now, some people have raised the claim that it only works if you are believing in it. I'm not sure if that's the case. They use it to some degree in veterinarian, animals and veterinary medicine and so on. But let's assume that it does do something. Now, does it do it because it unblocks meridians? I would say no. That's a pagan worldview. It's inconsistent with Scripture. If it does work, it either works by a demonic power or it works by a different physiologic premise. You understand? And so I'm not necessarily afraid of acupuncture just because it has a different explanation with it, especially if I can explain it on another principle. We do a treatment called prolotherapy, which is an injection with needles into damaged ligaments or tendons. And if I inject a medication into one, it may produce, with the anesthetic in there, it may relieve pain in an area that seems remote in the body. But there are neurophysiological connections to that. That impulse goes into the spine and it interacts with other nerves and goes out, and we've even mapped out these reflexes and so on. If you push on one point, if you overeat, for example, you can get bloating and pressure in the intestinal tract, and it can create pain in the back. Pain in the gallbladder area is referred to the shoulder. There are neurological reasons for that. It's not meridian energy. All right? Things are following a physical pathway, and it's happening because that is something that you can actually test and reproduce. Now, when people are testing acupuncture points and saying there's abnormality here and so on, I don't believe they're necessarily testing meridians. I think that what they're testing is skin resistance, just like a lie detector test. And they're measuring autonomic, sympathetic nervous system activity and so on. And when someone's got really sweaty palms because they're lying, it'll lower the skin resistance and it's detected electrically. It's a different reason, different explanation. Dr. Melzack at McGill University in Montreal found a 71% correlation between acupuncture points and known trigger points, like Travel triggers and so on. And so there's maybe a different explanation. All right. Now, acupressure or shiatsu, jijo, these are practices which are very similar to acupuncture, but they utilize pressure at the point instead of a needle. Same philosophy. All right. So here we have acupuncture and acupressure being a direct descendant, a direct result or outworking of the Taoist religion. Now, here are three practices which you see in America, even much more commonly now than acupuncture, which are all based on the same philosophy. The first is reflexology. This is acupressure of the feet. There is a diagram here of feet with the body's organs mapped out on the feet. And Dr. Fitzgerald was a doctor in the 1920s who devised the theory that the body had zones of energy and that you could modify them through manipulation. And a lady named Mrs. Fred Stoffel or Eunice Ingham brought them to the United States, where it is now practiced fairly commonly, especially by non-healthcare professionals. The idea is this: the feet are a microcosm of the human body, and that channels of energy end in the feet, and that when there are lumps that you can detect in the feet, you rub them real hard, those lumps are a result of the blockage of energy, they're little crystals, and then you rub them real hard and then they dissolve, the meridian is opened up, the energy flow is unblocked, and health is restored. I remember when a close acquaintance of mine came up to me one day and he said, "Well, I got my pancreas fixed today." And I said, I didn't know you had any problem with your pancreas. I see him almost every day and it seemed sick to me. I mean, if you have pancreatitis or something, you're sick. And he said, "Oh, yes." And I said, "Well, how do you know?" And he said, "Well, I went to my reflexologist and she checked my feet and found that I had a problem in my pancreas area and then she fixed it." So it's kind of a closed circle of logic. You diagnose it based on your theory, kind of like, you know, circular reasoning with the geological build up there in the their display and then the evolution. You know, you come up with your theory to explain the findings and then you use the findings to prove your theory. So it would not be very difficult to assess whether or not reflexology is really true and accurate. I haven't seen any research studies doing that. Now, the next one after reflexology, then, is iridology. This is diagnosis using the eye. Remember, the Chinese believe that the eye is a microcosm. Well, there was an 11-year-old boy named Ignaz von Pessely, who was a Hungarian, who was running through the forest at a very dense time and happened upon an owl who attacked him, sunk its talons into his arm, could not get free, and so in desperation he snapped the leg of the owl. And when he did that, he noticed a black line in the owl's eye as he looked at it in the eye, and the owl released him, and he went home. Years later, after he'd been trained as a natural practitioner and a homeopath in Vienna, a patient came in with a broken leg, and he saw a similar line in the patient's eye, and so he theorized that all disease would reflect itself in the eye. This was also theorized by Nils Lilquist in Sweden and brought to the United States in 1904 by Dr. Henry Lund. The a patient is usually examined, and the equipment can vary from a candle and a magnifying glass to very expensive, advanced photographic equipment, and they can blow it up on a big slide and show it to you in the office there. Well, the eye is supposedly, according to John Morley of the Iridology Research Institute, where the nervous system comes to the surface and the iris reflects via the nervous system all parts of the body and hence the mind and spirit too. And so iridologists believe that you can map out the entire human body and not only the body but the mind and spirit into the eye, and if there is a problem you will see it in the eye. Now I've seen this come into the church under the guise of the scripture, the light of the eye is the lamp of the body. Okay? Well, here's an iridology chart which shows you all these different organs mapped out in the chart. And when they see an irregularity in the iris, the colored portion of your eye, then they will look at a chart and then come up with a diagnosis. Well, has this been established by research? There have actually been several instances that I've been able to come across where this has been tested by hopefully objective outsiders, and this is what we've seen one of the problems with iridology is that there are at least 19 different iridology charts. So how do you pick which one is true? Fortunately, we have one scripture, you know what I mean, that has original manuscripts, verifiable, and we can go back to the truth. You can look at the Greek and the Hebrew and all that sort of thing. How can you tell? There's 19 different charts. So if a person doesn't get the right diagnosis, you just go pull a different chart. Well, there was a trial in the around the turn of the century. A famous iridologist and naturopath named Felke was put on trial for his practice of iridology. He was given 20 patients and tested before a jury. Now, every one of these patients had serious known diseases. He didn't know what they were, but they were well established. Things like amputations, you know, obvious. And he failed to correctly diagnose their problem in all 20 cases. And came up with some humorous other diagnoses. Klaser was another iridologist that was famous that was tested and failed 8 out of 8. In a study of 762 patients, 60 of whom were Army veterans, they also had, some of them had amputations from war injuries and so on, or diabetes and so on. Less than 3% had a sign in that portion of their eye that correlated with the diseased organ, which was severely diseased organ. This is examination by ophthalmologists. And then over 50% had some kind of an irregularity in a part of the iris that corresponded to a normal organ. Then there was also a study done at San Diego VA Medical Center in which there were 3 iridologists who were tested. Again, people with severe diseases, we weren't trying to, you know, split hairs here, no better than random guessing. You might as well flip a coin. So these are my conclusions on iridology. First of all, it's possible to explain Pesley's experience based upon the anatomy of the owl's eye. They have more than one eyelid, and they can have one closed in the eye and create the appearance of a line in the eye. Secondly, it appears from all these studies to be a very highly inaccurate diagnostic tool, and the scientific premises, especially for things like the mind and the spirit, seem worthless. But beyond that, just looking at the links between microcosm and macrocosm, it really seems suspicious. Now, secondly, most iridologists do not dabble in the occult, as far as I know. But there are some that do, and they will use it as a medium for psychic influence in a patient. And I would especially consider that possibility if you have an iridologist who has an incredibly accurate diagnostic track record. I mean, this guy always pins it. And I would ask, where is he getting his information? Because I don't think it's coming from the eye. So iridology is really, with this microcosm, is a direct descendant of Taoism. Now we got one more. These are going to progressively hurt your feelings. And that is applied kinesiology. George Goodhart is a chiropractor who in the 1970s in Detroit combined chiropractic theory with Oriental medicine, with the meridian theory of monism, Taoism. He did that intentionally. That was his theory he put together and based this practice on that. That's the roots of it. Basically, what you do is you take muscles, like we gave in our case presentation, and you test them for strength. Muscles will relate to various meridians, and if you have a weakness there, you have a blockage in that meridian, according to this theory. If you have too much energy or too little to the muscle, it'll be weak. They'll also use it to test the food allergies or whether or not a person needs a supplement or a medication, like I described in the opening case presentation. There are some people who say that didn't work at all on me. First of all, they really questioned it. And others who have said that, well, you need to really believe in it. And if you don't believe in it, it doesn't work. Let me ask you this. If you have a blood test for cardiac enzymes and you're in the middle of having serious chest pain, do you disqualify the principle that takes place? And it doesn't depend on whether or not you believe it. There is a faith factor that seems to play a part in these things as to whether or not they become a real bondage issue in somebody's life. I'm not saying it's 100%. Maybe you can get deceived and have bondage in your life even without really believing in the practice. But I'm saying that the people that I talk to who give me testimonies and things like that, that seem to be a faith factor. Faith went from this to this. Okay? Now, the problem here is when you combine this, even if the practice is neutral, it just is worthless as a diagnostic tool, or maybe it's not. Here's where you cross the line for sure, from what I can see. You start practicing divination when you start using the body to divine the dosage that a patient's going to be on. And that's done in various ways, and I've seen this practice in several ways. One is with the asking the body to tell you what the dosage is that you should be taking. Another is asking the body to confirm if there's something wrong with your organs, and they'll test the strength and say, is there anything wrong with your pancreas? And if they get weak, then that the answer is yes, there's something wrong with it. You know, those people who have been involved in the occult, what I've heard them say is that what you're doing is you're talking to a spirit guide. I mean, how can you explain that? Let's not throw away our minds in the process here. I'm not saying that everything has to be scientifically proven, but when you're talking to a person and saying, don't you try to answer me, I just want to detect this from your body, and your body is telling you things, how do you explain that? There's another individual who I know of who has an herb shop, and his wife works with him, and he puts his hand on his associate, and then she strength tests the patient while he's running his finger down a chart. And when she gets weak, he stops there, and that's the diagnosis. He's pointing to a piece of paper that has a diagram on it. You see how it starts getting more and more obvious? Starts subtle, then it gets more obvious. All right? And then there's others who say that they can do the testing over the telephone. Or just send me a photograph, and I'll tell you. That's divination. All right, so we have applied kinesiology, iridology, and reflexology, and acupuncture all having a very clear, overt tie with Taoism, a pagan-based medical system. Now, in India, you see more a different theory that arises, and this is hundreds of years before before Christ, and that is the concept of humoralism. What's humoralism? Well, the guy that really brought it into Western medicine, into Greek medicine, which ended up coming into Europe and so on, was named Pythagoras. Anybody ever heard of Pythagorean theorem? Well, this was the guy. He was really fascinated by the mathematical rule of four. He got fed up with the Greek gods that would fight with each other and everything, so he decided to go travel and learn something from some other culture, went to the East, and came back, and adopted a belief in transmigration of the soul, which is nothing other than reincarnation. But he got fascinated with the number four and said everything's in balance. He's got four seasons, four elements, four qualities, and four humors. And those are, I'll go into those in a minute. Well, India believed that there were three. Well, he dropped air and he added two other ones. And it's really sort of a probable elaboration of the yin and yang type of hypothesis. Well, the ones that he came up with were blood, phlegm, black, and yellow bile. And that when one fluid was in excess, the person would get disease. And so the treatment was to balance the body fluids back. And so, for example, if someone was having a fever and sweating, then you'd draw their blood. You'd do bloodletting. Or you'd put leeches on them if he was in a specific area. And that's what, you know, killed President Washington, who was our humoralist. And that was being employed. This is 500 BC. And humoralism was very actively practiced through the 1700s here in the U.S. It went for over 2,000 years, okay, as a predominant medical theory, which is at the roots of what modern medicine came from. Now, I want to mention something to you that I find kind of fascinating. It shows you what can happen. There was a pupil of Aristotle, came several hundred years after Pythagoras, who adopted the humoral theory. And he linked personalities with humors. And so he said those that were predominant in blood were sanguine, those that were predominant in phlegm were phlegmatic, those that were predominant in black bile were melancholic, and those that were predominant in yellow bile were cholerics. How many of you have had your temperament tested and come up as a melancholic or something? You know, that theory came from Theophrastus, came from Pythagoras, came from India. I don't see any basis for it in Scripture. Then what he emphasized then was treat the personality or the character of the patient, not the disease. So Pythagoras was a humoralist. And out of him came Hippocrates, the father of modern medicine. And he's credited with a lot of these things. He was born in about 460 BC, which is nearly 100 years later, in the island of Kos. Was a very well-known medical teacher, but most of the writings that have been attributed to him are not actually his. They were probably written by followers of him. He's famous for his Hippocratic Oath, which has been taken by doctors over the centuries in Western medicine, although many of the schools have deleted the oath not to give anything that would cause an abortion. And then he emphasized systematic observation, and this is what he's really famous for. He really challenged his students to carefully examine the patient and look them over very thoroughly, take a very thorough, detailed history, and be very systematic about that. Develop a system for doing that, so that you don't miss things. And that is really how medicine is practiced today. But he embraced humoral theory and came up with a term of vis medicatrix naturae, which means vital force, and that he called those things those measures which are taken automatically to repair or throw off the effects of poison. Through the like, disease is produced, and through the application of the like, it is cured. So he adopted a vital force kind of hypothesis and believed that sort of like cures like. And we're going to see this show up a little bit later. All right? We don't apply that in allopathic medical practice today. We believe that opposite cures. His treatment, though, was very conservative. Diet, rest. Some people got so fed up with him that they said that it's just a meditation upon death. That's all they do is sit there and look at the patient. Asclepius was one of the ones that was credited with saying that. And his descendants developed, his followers came up with what's called the doctrine of contraries. Instead of giving what was alike to cure alike, you give something that's opposite. And that's really where we get our allopathic theory. Allo means other. I'll read this definition from Dorland's Medical Dictionary. A term applied to that system of therapeutics in which diseases are treated by producing a condition incompatible with or antagonistic to the condition to be cured or alleviated. It's also called heteropathy. So allopathic medicine, most MDs are allopaths. That's something that they were given as a terminology for over 200 years now. I'm an osteopath. And an allopath has this view that we take a disease, it produces some symptoms, we oppose the symptoms. We give something to make it incompatible with the disease. So an antibiotic is given to bacterial infections, an antifungal to fungal infections, an antihypertensive to people with high blood pressure, an antidiarrheal to people with diarrhea, and so on and so on and so on. Now, the basic premise of allopathic medicine, and the reason why I'm saying this, because I want you not only to throw out the garbage in alternative medicine, but learn how to properly utilize orthodox medicine. All right? The basic premise of allopathic medicine is this, is that the body does not have the inherent capacity to heal itself. All right? Now, whether a doctor knows that or not, that's the premise upon which he's practicing. And so the doctor needs to intervene to do something to effect a cure. And so cancer's incurable. Well, I've seen cancers that have been cured by intervening more with diet and strengthening the body's ability to cure itself, to strengthen the body's own inherent healing properties. Now, it is true that there are situations in which the body cannot heal itself. And so, therefore, it's a good idea to go to an allopathically oriented physician. If it's a situation where that's not the correct premise, then that's probably not the kind of doctor to see. So, they were famous for very harsh treatments because they were trying to produce a situation incompatible with the illness in the body's in the person's body, and so they would use the bloodletting and leeches, like I mentioned. They would put blisters on, suction cups, toxic drugs. I remember hearing the case, it was one of the French kings who had gone through this incredible array of treatments, and he finally was getting ready to die, and he apologized to his physicians for taking so long after they went through all this. Toxic drugs were used, the mercury, calomel, quinine, opium, morphine, bromide, strychnine, and so if, you know, the patient's hair would fall off and everything. It was pretty rough. And if you did survive the treatment, then you were probably going to be okay. Now, so we have humoralism and allopathic medicine coming off of that. Now, I thought I had a slide right there. I'm not sure if it's going to come up here later. But allopaths have not stuck with their humoral philosophy. As the microscope was invented, as the stethoscope was invented, as we got into learning more and more, it was only in the 1600s that William Harvey discovered that Galen was wrong and that the blood truly circulated and your heart didn't keep making more and more every second. We're only talking 300 years of real, genuine scientific discovery. All right? And so any medical profession can have a false basis but then take advantage of new discovery and implement them into their practice. So it's not necessarily all or none, okay? And so what really happened is that there were two factors that squelched the development of scientific inquiry. By far the strongest was a man named Galen, Claudius Galen, who was the physician to five emperors around 100 AD, and was an incredibly popular physician, and did public autopsies, dissections of animals to audiences to show them and teach them all these things, and basically entrenched in the thinking humoralism for centuries. No one dared cross paths with Galen. I mean, if there was a physician that was the personal doctor to five presidents, and these guys lived, you know, reigned longer than 4 years, you know, he'd be a pretty powerful influence in the field of medicine. And if you were some little upstart out of a medical school and came up with an idea contrary to Galen, your neck was on the line. Literally. Okay? And after Galen died, the medical history books say it was the Dark Ages of medicine. Now, a lot of people think it was a church. The church was an influence, but it came later. The church began to have more power when the Roman Catholic Church, you know, was merged with the Roman government. And then, later on in the Middle Ages, they squelched some of the scientific inquiry by determining whether or not a scientist could say. Copernicus crossed paths with the Roman Catholic Church because they believed that the earth with man was at the center of the universe. Now, is there anything in Scripture that says that? No. And Copernicus said, no, I think the earth revolves around the sun. And he got in trouble. Galileo was called before a tribunal who affirmed Copernicus' findings, and Galileo was told, you need to recant your statements about this. Of course, he refused to do so. And you know what? He didn't die. And scientists began to discover things and found out that they were contrary to what the church was letting them say. And I'm not saying this is necessarily the true church. I'm telling you that it was the perceived church, the Roman Catholic Church. And so they didn't die. They developed a camaraderie in the scientific community. And the Renaissance is born. And it was seen as a rebellion against the authority of the church. And the church didn't use wisdom there. And it's suffered ever since. And what's happened is medicine and science has developed totally apart now from the influence of the church. Whereas it started, medicine was really initiated the way we see it today, more so in the church than anywhere else. The followers of Christ in the first centuries after Christ were the ones that invented the first hospitals. And they were committed to carrying out the example of Christ, to caring for the sick and the poor and the destitute. And they were so effective that a Roman emperor named Julian the Apostate said, now we know why these Christians are such powerful enemies of our gods. It's because of their brotherly love for the poor and the stranger. And he proposed setting up hospitals as a counter-propaganda device to keep Romans coming to them instead of going over to the church. Yes, ma'am. I believe so. Can you imagine Jesus? The question was, is it a scriptural practice for churches to bring nurses and doctors back into the church to do this? And I would ask you, what would Jesus' ministry be if he wasn't involved in healing? And I really think that this is a serious need. Now, we need to be careful not to make the same mistakes that were made with Galileo and people like that. And I think there is a benefit to having a medical profession that is more of a separate entity in terms of being somewhat for profit, because there needs to be incentive. A lot of times I've seen that when you bring a profession under the direction of the church doesn't understand it, and they end up being antagonistic towards it. And there's an incentive for discovery and so on out there, not just from personal interest, but a worker's worth his wages. He ought to be able to gain from that and better himself and so on. But our ministry is, the purpose of it is to help churches to bring medicine and healthcare back into the church. Not necessarily that we would have all of our own hospitals and doctors and clinics and staff, but that we would teach our people to be wise, that pastors and leaders in the church would maybe have a physician on staff that they could consult with, and maybe, like, I go with our pastor occasionally to the hospital, and I'll be able to look at charts and talk with patients and their doctors and so on, help him give wise advice and learn how to utilize the medical profession more efficiently. And I'll talk a little bit more about that before we're done. But let's talk a little bit about divination, because this is what you really see in the polytheistic societies. This is from Wycliffe's Encyclopedia, 1988. The attempt to discern future events by such means as trances, visions, etc., or physical objects. These were varied. Rhabdomancy, the throwing of sticks or arrows into the air, and then when they land, you make a determination, almost like flipping a coin. Hepatoscopy, examination of the liver or other organs of an animal. Teraphim, images used for divination. Necromancy, communication with the dead. Astrology, reading the stars and coming to conclusions on the basis of their positions and relations to each other. 6. Hydromancy, divination with water, done either by noting the reflections or inducing a trance by this means. God sternly condemns all means of seeking hidden knowledge and knowledge of the future apart from his divine revelation. From what I read, it was a Catholic monk who reasoned, hey, if he could use hydromancy and divine where water channels were going underneath their monastery with a stick, then why couldn't he tell where the flow was going with the blood and everything in a human being, and brought radionics and radiesthesia into medicine? This is what God says about divination. In Deuteronomy 18, there shall not be found among you anyone that maketh his son or his daughter to pass through the fire, or that useth divination, or an observer of times, or an enchanter, or a witch, or a charmer, or a consulter with familiar spirits, or a wizard, or a necromancer. For all that do these things are an abomination unto the Lord, and because of these abominations the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee. Thou shalt be perfect with the Lord thy God, for these nations which thou shalt possess hearkened unto observers of times and unto diviners, but as for thee, the Lord thy God hath not suffered thee so to do. Now, I am not saying that you can't get information by doing this. The question is whether or not God wants you to have it. You ever see that story of Hezekiah when he was facing death, when he was sick, and God sent Isaiah to tell him, you're going to die, make your house ready? Hezekiah turned over in his bed and wept against the wall, and God spoke to Isaiah, said, I've heard Hezekiah's prayer, go back up and tell him I've extended his life. So Isaiah went up and told Hezekiah that God had heard his prayer and he was extending his life. Do you know what happened next? It says Isaiah made a poultice and applied it to Hezekiah, and he got well. Question I have is, if it says it, I wonder if Isaiah knew about the poultice before, but God had decreed that it was Hezekiah's time to go, and therefore he wasn't going to offer him any medical treatment. And Hezekiah shouldn't pursue it. And do you know what happened in Hezekiah's life as a result of his life being extended? He sinned greatly against God in revealing all of the treasures to his enemies. He raised up the most wicked son that the nation of Israel ever had, Manasseh. Sometimes it's better to go when God says, probably always better to go when God says to go. I'm not saying that you can't get the information. The question is, does God really want you to have it? Are you willing to stay underneath his protection and direction in your life? Alchemy is a byproduct that was developed in Egypt and Mesopotamia where the craftsmen would use chemical reactions to make weapons and tools and things like that, and they would make bronze by melting copper with tin. They didn't understand why the changes took place, and so they came up with various theories like they did in China and so on, and to try to explain these chemical reactions. Well, alchemists were famous. I got this. These slides didn't get correctly put here. I'm sorry. That got moved. Alchemists come off of polytheism and the divination end. All right. So you have these two ends here, and from divination, then you have alchemy, and this is something that became really strong after the turn of the millennium. 300 AD to 1600 AD, when we did not understand much about chemistry. And they would design balances and crucibles. These are the precursors of chemists. All right? And the center for alchemy was Alexandria. Well, what they would do is apply their theories, and what they were really a lot of them were after, they wanted to get rich. And there's a classic cartoon that you'll see of alchemists who have these crucibles and things like this, and they're experimenting on body fluids and with chemicals and so on, and their house is in rags and shambles, and their family's poor, while he's trying to learn how to change lead or iron into gold, or looking for the elixir of youth that would provide him the long or unending life. It is listed as an occult practice in today's encyclopedias. Alchemy is. Now, the reason why I bring that up is because of a man named Paracelsus, who is heralded as a hero in alternative medicine. Paracelsus lived from 1493 to 1541. He was called Paracelsus because his real name was Philippus Aurelius Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim. And it was much easier just to call him Paracelsus. And so that's what people did. He was a Swiss doctor and an alchemist, and he was the son of a physician, but he got disillusioned early on in life, and so he went out traveling to Europe and the East and so on, and came back with his theories and opened up a practice. But he was very proud and he was brash, and his ideas really provoked some reactions, so nobody was willing to publish anything until after he died. But what did he teach? First of all, he introduced some significant things into medicine that stuck for a while, with the use of lead, sulfur, iron, and arsenic as medicaments. And then he also believed that the basic substances like you see in China and India and so on were earth, fire, water, and air. But he denounced Galen and Avicenna, who was the principal author of an anatomy text that was the text for hundreds of years, from 900 or so on. And that made him very unpopular. But he also had some very mystical ideas. He got really into the astrology and so on, and believed in a life force which radiated from the imagination of the physician. Therefore, it was much more important what the physician's character was rather than the remedy that was offered. And he also believed in like cures like we mentioned with Hippocrates, and it was with morphologic similars. For example, if there was a plant or a flower that was shaped like an ear, and someone had an earache, he would give that. Okay, so like cures like. He'd take what looked similar in nature, and he would give it there to the patient. So Paracelsus was an alchemist, and he was into some weird stuff, and used the principle of like cures like and so on. Now we also have radionics. Now radionics is, like I talked, that's kind of the water witching and so on, and taking that into the realm of medicine where you're using pendulums or things like that to diagnose somebody. And I think strength testing is maybe you're using somebody's muscle just like you're using a pendulum. That's a possibility. But radionics is really just outright divination. You're using pendulums or some instrument to try to discern something that you don't know. The father of much of modern-day life force theory or vital theory is considered in alternative medicine textbooks to be Frank Mesmer. Now, he is an interesting character. He was born in Austria in the mid-1700s, watched a Swiss father stroke pain out of a body, and studied medicine in Vienna and developed a theory of animal magnetism, which later was referred to as mesmerism. And this was something that provoked quite a reaction in the medical community, and so he left and went to Paris for calmer waters in 1778. Well, this is what he believed. The doctor, essentially, was serving as a medium, and that there was a mysterious fluid that penetrated all of our bodies. And so what he would do is, this allowed us to have an influence over one another person, and we'd call it a magnetic influence. And that this healing force was magnetic. It wasn't mineral like the alchemists, like Paracelsus would believe, and that it could pass from the doctor to somebody else. So what they would do is they would stand around in a circle and hold a seance. The patients would touch or hold hands, and they would go through this ritual, and people would go into convulsions or start saying strange voices or things like that, things that might be very similar to stuff you deal with in spiritual warfare counseling, from what it sounds to me. Well, because of this, a government French committee was commissioned by the king to investigate Mesmer and find out whether or not he was really legitimate. Interestingly enough, an American ambassador to France named Ben Franklin was on that committee, along with Lavoisier, who was a famous chemist, and a Dr. Guillotin, who invented an instrument which was used later on against the royalty. And they came up with the conclusion that this was totally suggestive, that there was nothing really inherent in the treatment itself, and the theories were rejected. But hypnotism and mesmerism still plays a very prominent role in alternative medicine today. And so you see mesmer really coming under this line of divination and the radionics and his theory of animal magnetism. Now, I mentioned alchemy for Paracelsus and radionics for mesmer because they come together in homeopathy with Samuel Hahnemann. And I'll show you how that happens. Hahnemann was born in the mid-1700s, shortly 20 years after mesmer, in Saxonia. He was the son of a porcelain painter and studied medicine in three different cities and married and had 9 children. But he tried private practice in a number of different occasions and failed quite miserably. And so in order to supplement his income, he would translate medical textbooks from 3 different languages. Well, what did he find? He was reading in a textbook one time about the effects of quinine on malaria. And he decided he was, for whatever reason, he was going to try quinine on himself. So he tried some quinine, and it gave him fever, chills, malaise, and so on, which sounds like a real bad allergic reaction to me. But he reasoned that since people who have malaria get fever and chills and malaise, it wasn't the disease that was producing the symptoms, it was the remedy. And the symptoms were actually the body's life force trying to throw off the disease, and that's why they got the symptoms. And it's not necessarily that far out-fetched that you would think that the symptoms are what are producing, are being produced by the immune system or something like that. But it gets a little bit more questionable here. So the treatment was to give something to augment that body's life force, that which some people say, well, that's just the immune system. So you're giving something to try to strengthen it because, in other words, you want to give somebody something that gives them more fever if he's having a fever because that will end up improving his life force. He also really got into the diagnosis by personality, similar to Theophrastus, and placed a very big emphasis on properly assessing the personality or character of the patient and matching that up with the personality or character of the remedy. Now, because of that, what they came up with was the principle of proving. So what he would do is he would have his students or himself take remedies, even though they were well, and see what symptoms they got, and then they would write them down. Okay? And they would begin to list all these symptoms. So you'd take some strychnine in a small dose and start getting muscle spasms and shortness of breath, and so they would write those things down. All right? And that's called the principle of proving. The problem, as I had on that previous screen, is that they have like over 1,400 symptoms for belladonna, 1,200 for nux vomica, which is a very common remedy used by the homeopaths. But here's the other principles upon which homeopathy is based after the principle of proving. The first is the principle of similars. Just like Hippocrates and Paracelsus, he says the remedy will cure the disease, but if it produces in the person symptoms in the healthy that are like that of the disease. All right? So for example, does everybody know that if you drink a lot of castor oil, what will happen? The diarrhea, right? All right, so imagine what you would think if your patient, if you come into me and you're saying, Doc, I have some terrible rip-roaring diarrhea. It's been going for 2 weeks now. I cannot stop the trots. And do you have a remedy for you? And I say, well, here's some castor oil. No, you can't do that. So here's the second principle, and that is the principle of dilution. You use the smallest possible amount of that remedy and give it to the patient with those symptoms. For example, they'll dilute a solution down to 12x. That's a kind of a mild homeopathic solution in which there's only 1 cc of original and 1 times 10 to the 12 zeros of solvent. That's equivalent to putting a teaspoon of active substance into a volume of water the size of the Empire State Building. A 12c solution is equivalent to 1 cc of original in 1 times 10 to the 24th, which is equivalent to a similar amount of original substance in a volume the size of the Atlantic.
assuming that it's 81 million square kilometers with an average depth of 3,700 meters. A 30x solution, one drop in 1 times 10 with 30 zeros behind it, solution, has no active substance in it anymore. You could not, according to Avogadro's hypothesis, you cannot find a molecule anymore of that substance, and yet there are solutions that are more than 30x or 30C. And then there's the principle of potentiation, and this is really important. In order to make a homeopathic remedy that's a 6x solution, we'll use this as an example, you take one drop of original solution, put it in 9 drops of solvent. You shake it up real well in a certain way, with a certain amount of shaking. It's called succussion. Now you have a 1x solution, 1/10 the strength of the original. And you take one drop of that and you put it into 9 drops of a plain solvent again, succuss it for a while. Now you have a 2x solution. You have 1/100th strength. Then you take one drop of that, you succuss it in 9 drops of another solvent, and you get 3x. And you keep going like that to a 6x solution, which is a solution that has one drop in 1 million of original solution. That's 6x. Well, why don't you just take a drop and add it to 999,000 drops of solvent and shake it up real well? That's what you would do if you were baking a cake, wouldn't you? Well, Hahnemann says that there's much more to the process here than simple dilution. But what you're doing is you are releasing dynamic energies which are retained in that substance, which is the cosmic vital force. It was referred to as a spiritual vital force, which would then transfer itself to the homeopathic solution. And he believed that you were effecting the same thing as Frank Mesmer was, but you're doing it through a chemical cure rather than through a seance. That's what he said. Now, let me give you a couple of definitions from an occult encyclopedia. This is their own definitions on occultism. Occultism denotes a philosophical system of theories and practices on and for the attainment of the higher powers of mind and spirit. Its practical side connects with psychical phenomena. That's occultism. Here's magic. It's from the Greek word magikos, which is a practice based upon, one, the laws of sympathy. That's like cures like. If a bloodstone, if someone is having a bleeding, then you take a bloodstone to stop it. Okay? Or a homeopathic remedy falls right in line with that. Like cures like. Or antipathy, which is the application of an object which expels its contrary. And thirdly, contiguity. Whatever has once formed part of an object continues to have an invisible bond to it. That's the definition of magic from an occult encyclopedia. So here's some concerns we have with homeopathy. First of all, Hahnemann was a Freemason. He spoke highly of Confucius, but he disparaged Christ. He said, quote, Christ did not lead the enlightened on the straight way to wisdom, didn't set them all free from their diseases and so on. And he has links to underlying Eastern ideology. He used terms vital force, harmony with the universe. Followers used the terms ethereal body. The very famous homeopath, a Swiss named Adolf Vogli, says the best explanation for homeopathy is Hindu Sankhya philosophy, in which man has an ethereal body and an energy channels. You have a physical body and an ethereal body with energy channels surrounding it. That's Sankhya philosophy. And many followers embraced astrology, and pendulums have also been used to diagnose or prescribe homeopathic remedies. So just reasons for concerns. It doesn't necessarily each one of them disqualify it, but you have to really raise your red flag. There was a homeopath who did some scientific testing. Can't remember his name right now. It was in the book by Sam Pfeiffer called Healing at Any Price, which I think is out of print now. It's published by Word Books, in which he said, he quotes a homeopath who began to question whether or not what he was doing was really legitimate. And so he began to test patients with placebos and homeopathic remedies. And he found an interesting thing. This is what he recorded anyway. He said that patients who didn't believe in homeopathy had no effect with either solution, the placebo, the sugar solution, or the homeopathic remedy. But those that really believed in homeopathy had violent reactions from the placebo. Not even the homeopathic remedy. It created violent reactions. And he changed his mind about it and decided not to practice anymore. And I'm not sure if it was his quote or someone else's, but they said, homeopathy can serve as a beachhead for the enemy and can lead to occult oppression. There are people in New Age medicine who have an ambition of getting to people and winning them over to New Age philosophy through healthcare, through medicine. And that's why this is so important to be aware of these things, because you might be really solid on your biblical doctrine, but I've sure met a lot of people in the church now since beginning to teach this who have totally sold themselves out in this area of medicine. And they're as deceived as brethren that they might be trying to cast out demons from. I mean, it's really amazing. And even after presenting this material, sometimes people come up and say, you know, I remember last time in Cincinnati, and someone says, you know, we go to a Baptist minister who does all of those things, and it really works. Of course, you know, Pharaoh's magicians could do all those things that Moses could do. So you're going to go to the magicians, or you go to Moses? They can have power too. Question is, what's the source? And one thing that I have observed and was mentioned in Pfeiffer's book as well is that many times what I see in homeopathic families that are really practicing it, and it's usually the initiation, it's usually the wife who's leading this crusade, and the husband's just kind of out of touch with what's happening, is the remedies seem to help the symptoms temporarily, but what you see is their family just going downhill physically. They're sicker and sicker. They're the most sickly people in the church. And the question is it really, really bringing healing? I mean, maybe it brings the fever down like nothing else. But what's the end result? So you have homeopathy here with links to Paracelsus and alchemy, with links to Mesmer, and also links with some of the dark side of Hippocrates. He was not a believer. And we see those things there. Now, I want to mention to you vitalism. And I didn't have time to really make up this slide, but I want to, well, I guess I did. I want to read you a little something here. This is a textbook called Fundamentals of Complementary and Alternative Medicine. I purchased it when I was at a national convention on alternative medicine in Washington, D.C. 2 years ago. And I'll read you the beginning here. Health is accessible. Subtle healing, health-promoting influences pervade the alternative healing world. This is a textbook for physicians. Health is accessible through universal beneficent healing influences. The universe is thought to provide an endless influx of forces that can help to put things right. Health is harmony in the cosmic energy. Illness is cured by reordering the protective forces. A person threatened by disorder and disease is guaranteed a response from fundamentally benign, lawful, coherent, potent, and even meaningful powers. One can almost speak of a faucet that pours out healing juice. Homeopathy connects with the spiritual vital force. Chiropractic calls it innate or universal intelligence. Psychic healing manipulates auric, psi, or psionic powers. Believers in new thought are restored by a correct mind. Acupuncture utilizes ki. Ayurvedic medicine and yoga teachers are in much with prana, and naturopaths invoke the vis medicatrix naturae. Unseen powers are said to permeate the universe and have a profound effect on human beings undetectable by scientific instruments. It also says in that chapter, the proposition that more is needed to explain life than just physical or mechanical laws is what vitalism is, and this is what permeates all of New Age medicine, this idea of vitalism. And it permeates a majority of alternative or complementary medicine as well. The concept of vitalism really became revived in elite universities in the 18th and 19th centuries after this reaction to the scientific. What happened was when they threw out the church in the Renaissance, then the doctors all believed that all there was to the world was what you see, the physical realm. So they threw out the spiritual. And then later on, there was a reaction to that to bring the spiritual back, but it wasn't being brought back by the church. it was brought back by occult influences, and what was taught in the universities in the 18th and 19th centuries was this idea of vitalisms, and things in medicine were very spiritualistic in the last century and before that, in the 1700s, 1800s, and so on. Now, what they did was, in this textbook here, they classify mesmerism into lower and higher mesmerism. And this is what they say. Alternative therapies that speak of an electromagnetic dimension which can become depleted or unbalanced, causing the blockage of energy flow, requiring physical or spiritual cleaning in order for healing to occur. There is therapeutic touch. This has really come into the nursing corps. Paranormal healing. And then there's another quote. Countless individual psychic, auric, and psionic healers, while often unaware of their heritage, all bear the characteristic mesmeric style of manipulating unseen and refined forces that evade biomedical detection. Lower mesmerism is the belief that there's this vital force that permeates our bodies that has more of a physical nature to it. And it's imparted physically. That's why it's through therapeutic touch or things like that. All right? Higher mesmerism believes that it's more of a spiritual nature, that you would deal with it more through prayer or meditation or things like this. The trance states of higher mesmeric traditions were used to contact non-corporeal realities, meaning beings without a body. Healing dispensations, medical diagnosis, or medical advice were a common product of tuning in, as was clairvoyance, spirit sightings, levitations, ectoplasmic emissions, table turning, spirit tapping, and spirit photographs. What I referred to earlier, where you send your photograph to a healer and he looks at it and tells you what's wrong. This spiritualist movement was later reincarnated in various theosophical and occult movements in today's New Age scene. You got to be very careful when you get into things like, who are you praying to? What are you imaging? And things like that. And, you know, are you staying under the sovereignty of God or are you not? You have to use some real discernment there. Quote, past lives therapy are involved with a panoply of spiritual beings detectable by mesmeric trances, currently spoken of as altered states of consciousness, channeling, higher states of awareness, or transmission of spiritually evolved beings. We have lower mesmerism, higher mesmerism, basically all this vitalism, and you'll see this energy permeating, this idea of energy. You can't measure it, really. You can't see it. You can't test it. It's very